My name is Amina Keshtan Kamel, and I'm conducting this discussion between all of us. We'll go from my right around. Go ahead.
My name is Andrew Theory. I'm a 2L here at ASU. I'm with the Law, Science, and Innovation Center, and I'm also on Geometrics.
I'm Jim Gatto with Shepard Mullen in the Intellectual Property Group there and co-head of the Social Media and Games Practice.
I'm Bryce Blum, co-founder of IME Law. I have a full-time practice around esports law.
I'm Tim Hagem. I'm an attorney with Pain and Fears, where a couple years ago I launched the esports practice, and it's interdisciplinary practice with a number of different lawyers working exclusively on esports.
I'm Mike Krowick. I'm a 3L at ASU, president of Volunteer Legal Assistance for Artists, which does a lot of IP-type work with a lot of topics related to this.
I'm Caleb McKay, a 2L here at ASU, just very interested in the topic of esports.
All right.
Sure, I'll lead off with some industry trends that I've noticed. A lot of the sort of foundational esports like Quake and Tribes like didn't start out that way. It was just a very organic process as people got better at the game and decided they wanted to do it professionally. The competitive nature of that just kind of grew organically out of that. And now we're seeing, I think Overwatch is a prime example of a game that's been cultivated from the start, from the ground up, as a competitive game. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Is this something you see happening more in the future? Is this sort of a test case? Is it going to work?
I think it's going to be a mix. I think that there are certain games that lend themselves better to esports. I think certain, within different types of games, I think there's different ways you can structure the game to make it more amenable. I think a lot of people want their games to be good for esports, and they're not. And so I think, there's going to be a kind of a mix. I think that there's that. I think that as things continue to evolve, you'll see more games that are kind of built from the beginning for that, and with mechanics in it, and just even the gameplay that are designed to make it an esports attractive offering.
So you can't force an esport, right? So if the game isn't compelling to play, compelling to watch, it's not going to be successful. But, and I think the first example is actually League of Legends, not Overwatch, right? Which is that was a game that was created around the thesis that a competitive video game infrastructure could be as successful as a competitive sporting structure. And so from the very early days of that game, they were designing it not just to be fun to play, but fun to watch. And I think given the evolution of esports today, you're going to see more and more games that are released not just with the player in mind, but the spectator in mind, and concepts like visual clarity that are becoming really important now in game design that historically weren't. And all you need to be able to do is, when you're playing the game, can you figure out what's happening? And now it's, if you're not playing the game and you're spectating it, can you figure out what's happening? And that's actually a fundamentally different question and different type of problem to solve. And I think we'll see more publishers intentionally going down that route from the outset, whether they're successful or not.
In some games, you can see kind of clearly struggle with whether or not they have an esports identity. The example that comes to mind for me is Hearthstone. Mm-hmm. I think that's a game that they've certainly tried to make into an esport, and a number of teams have professional Hearthstone players on them. But the game also has very much a casual feel to it, and it's meant to be a game that's primarily played, or at least can be played, on mobile devices.
And
it's meant to be
free to play as well. Without
and free to play, right? And I think it's competitive with things like Candy Crush and whatever. And because it has more casual feel to it, and also there's a lot of randomness in it, it has in some sense hampered the growth of the esports side of Hearthstone. So I think sometimes publishers are going to have to make a decision between making a really competitive esports game and making something that's maybe more casual or more user friendly.
And then there's the hybrid of that, where I don't know how successful companies will be doing this, but trying to have a game that the masses can play, but have either aspects or levels or versions of it that are more designed for esports. So you kind of try to bridge both gaps. I think that's really hard to do in a given game, but I think you'll see people try to do that as well.
So if we've got, on the one hand, the companies that are putting a lot into developing an esports scene, and you know they're trying very hard to create that from the outset, we've got, on the other hand, Nintendo and Smash Brothers, where Smash popped up as this esport back in Melee. Nintendo was very reluctant about it, and to this day, they're still really, they're kind of trigger happy with their DMCAs. They make it tough for people to monetize Nintendo content on YouTube, etc. And yet, there's this flourishing Smash Melee still community and now Smash 4. How is the industry kind of looking at that, or is the industry looking at that and saying, like, well, there's more to it than even our best efforts can create?
ultimately it's the publisher's call, right? It's their IP. And so in the case that you're giving, I think Nintendo's being short-sighted, and as someone that works full-time in the esports industry, I look at all the benefits, and I think they strongly outweigh the risks here, but Nintendo's going to do what Nintendo's going to do, and if they really hate esports and don't want to, they don't want to invest in, they don't want to grow the esports, they want to actively prevent people from producing content around their game, for whatever reason, they're going to do that.
I think it's also important to remember, kind of like I was saying a moment ago, designing a game with esports in mind is difficult. One of the major criticisms of games that are quote-unquote esports titles is things like balancing and matchmaking. How do you do that effectively in a way that doesn't compromise the integrity of the competitive element of the game? How do you do it in a way that you really can have robust competitions and you can have the same, you can have dynasties, you can have the same sorts of things that you see in traditional sports? That's hard for a game developer to do. And if a game developer just doesn't have the apparatus or the interest in doing it, they're probably going to make more casual games. They're going to make games that are just designed to be played at home, you know, between friends or whatever. I think that's where they have to kind of make a decision between which kind of game they want to make.
I actually have a follow-up question with that. You said something earlier about how, you know, we all used to, especially me, not so much sports-related games, but I used to do online gaming all the time as a 12-year-old. And my parents would always be like, what are you doing? But now it's boomed into this industry. When do you think that transition happened? I know I've been having that conversation with people, and they're like, it's the digital age. But I'm getting so tired of that stereotypical answer. I feel like there's something else, or maybe there isn't.
In terms of what elevated esports to where it is today, where it's now, I think it's trickle-down effect, right? Esports have become more mainstream, therefore more culturally acceptable, therefore different stereotypes around who are gamers and what does it mean to be a gamer. I really think of it as kind of a track that started around 2011, and it started with not just the launch of League of Legends, but its really explosive growth, and simultaneously not just the launch of Twitch, but its explosive growth. And so what you had was right game, right place, right time. And so you had this game that became a global phenomenon. More than 1% of the world population has played a game of League of Legends. They have over 100 million monthly active users of just that game alone. So it's massive and therefore ubiquitous. And then you've got Twitch, which is this not just a League of Legends distribution platform, but a gaming platform more broadly. And what you did is you created a platform where gamers all over the world, but particularly in Western areas where this is newer, right, because esports and gaming have been bigger in China and Korea historically than they have been in the West, to really engage with that content. And you've seen explosive growth of Twitch. I mean, I quoted these stats earlier, right, that Twitch has more users who come back to the site more often and consume more content on average than Hulu or Netflix. Like, it is the major live streaming platform in the West today. And people don't view it that way. They would, you know, if you were asked someone about live streaming, Twitch wouldn't immediately come to mind, but it should. And I think that's where you've seen this real impact on the stereotypes you're talking about.
I would add to that too. I think that's, as far as esports specifically, I would agree with all that. I think there's also kind of this taking a step back, the broader view of games and gamers. I think we talked earlier that you know, one of the fastest growing demographics for gamers is not kids under, you know, guys under 21 with a, you know, a console in the basement, but moms and women 35 to 50. And so I think you have this just overall broader demographic or more ubiquitous demographic of people playing games. And I think, you know, you were asking about what was the trigger or what, you know, I think, you know, kind of mobile games really kind of changed that, right? So, you know, there was not a lot of historically moms playing console games, right? You know, they called the kids up when they were time for dinner and, you know, like, what are you doing down there? But now, like, you know, as they're, you know, playing the games more ubiquitously and some of the social games, I think the whole concept of games has become much more culturally ingrained. And I think that all of these things together have kind of boosted the game industry as a whole. The fact that people can appreciate the complexity of playing games and playing them well. And so I think that kind of gave the esports an uplift. And so I think it's really all of that that really has contributed to it.
No, that makes sense. I definitely see that pattern. I mean, what does that mean for consumer rights, though? Because now, as you said, it's a service. It's not really, you're not buying games anymore and installing them. You can live stream. So, I mean, I, from a legal standpoint, I mean, even my expertise is music copyright, music streaming. So right now I'm exploring that aspect of music because it's kind of having that transition as well. You have something like Spotify where you can, it's very different, but it works, it's music streaming globally.
I think in many respects it's similar to any other copyright issue. You take music, right? So there's different bundles of rights, and there's different copyright owners, and there's different licensing schemes, and all that kind of works, and it's kind of established. And I think kind of esports is kind of getting there. I think that the when you look at the games as we talked about earlier, I mean, the games themselves are copyrighted, and so there's the rights, just like with WWE or boxing matches. I mean, if you're a bar and you want to display something, right, you got to have a different license than if you're a consumer playing at home. And so those copyright issues are kind of similar to all of those types of things. They manifest themselves a little bit differently in some of these respects, but I think it's pretty much analogous in many respects.
That makes sense.
I think you're also seeing different revenue models to handle some of these intellectual property issues, right? I mean, the way more and more now you see Twitch and YouTube, they're making a lot of money through ad revenue. But then there's also, with Twitch, there's donations, there's subscription models and such. And you see the same thing with Spotify, right? Now, instead of buying a song from iTunes or from Amazon, I just pay a monthly subscription and I can listen to any music I want. And I think more and more now, broadcasters are realizing that there are different ways for them to make money. They don't have to trade in old systems or old models, old ways of doing business.
Well, and also what a broadcaster is has changed too, right? So you have the indie streamers and others, which is, different. You typically don't have that in pro sports, for example. So, and, some of the revenue sharing models and some of the streaming services and, the fact that indies can kind of make money, I think that just kind of that is a difference, I think, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
It puts a different set of legal issues out there.
So, I'll go ahead.
How far, now that you're talking about broadcasters, how far do you think we are from collective bargaining? I know there was something that Monte Cristo did in an interview saying that Overwatch, Blizzard for Overwatch has paid him more in 2 weeks than League paid him for, 5 weeks of their world championship. And he went on this big rant about just the way that League and Riot treat their shoutcasters. And so are there a lot of issues kind of brewing right under the surface with all that? Is there a CBA or something like that on the horizon? Any kind of development?
So when you talk about collective bargaining in esports, you have to carve out the different possibilities for how that comes together. So specifically on the broadcasting rights side, I think it's unlikely there's going to be a CBA in place for broadcasters. The problem is broadcasters tend to be freelance. They tend to work across multiple titles. And so figuring out a way to bring all of those parties to the table under one CBA is really hard. It's why sports broadcasters don't have a union, by the way. Right? They have representation. They advocate for their interests. Sometimes they do that as a group, but not as a union in the same sense that exists in traditional sports. Now, when you're talking about unionization in esports, you have to remember that there are a much larger number of relevant parties than there are traditional sports. So when we think about the NFL or the NBA, you essentially have a two-party system. You've got players, and you've got teams that own the league, right? The teams own the NFL. The teams own the NBA. They're all co-owners. They hire the commissioner, who's their representative. That creates a bi-party negotiation structure. In esports, depending on the game you're talking about, you've got always have a publisher, always have teams, always have players, and then in some cases you have third-party tournament organizers that are heavily involved and probably deserve a seat at the bargaining table.
And potentially arenas,
yeah. Although I think arenas to me feel more like a service provider, less intimately involved in the ecosystem and likely to be at the bargaining table, but still, absolutely. Whereas in traditional sports, the teams own the arenas, right? Or at the very least have some sort of long-term lease with the city for the arena itself. So in terms of how the bargaining comes together, I mean, I wrote about this 3 years ago. I think whenever we see a union, like players union, air quotes, players union in esports, what you're going to actually have is players and teams together on one side of the table against publisher / league operator on the other side of the table. I think that's how that plays out. There are certainly areas where player and team interests are divergent, but I think vis-a-vis bargaining around infrastructure in esports, they're way more aligned than they are divergent.
Following up on that, what about WISA, where we have ESL and then teams on like the same side of the table? So it seems, is there a conflict of interest there potentially, or how is that going to work?
They're not on the same side of the table. The way WISA is set up, right? You have it's a five-party decision-making structure. Teams got two votes. WISA or the ESL, right, has two votes, and players have one vote. And so theoretically, if players and teams are aligned on that, they can actually outvote ESL when it comes to like rules changes. So. Mm-hmm. I also don't think of WISA as necessarily the model because it's a little unusual, right? It merges in Counter-Strike where the publisher's not involved. I think we're going to see a trend towards more publisher involvement, not less. And so I think bargaining structure that doesn't meaningfully involve a publisher is difficult on some level, because at no matter what Lisa does, at some point in time, if Valve decides we don't like that, then they just immediately cut them off at the knees, and then it doesn't matter. You can vote all you want, you can build all the infrastructure you want, but if Valve says no, you're stuck.
Sure.
We were talking about gambling a little while ago and skin betting, and that's only possible in certain games, right? The game needs to actually create the avenues for players to trade skins. I know Overwatch doesn't let you do that.
Correct. League doesn't let you do that.
Yeah.
Valve is actually the only publisher that does this and that meaningfully allows the secondary market, right? I know this.
Well, there's been others in the past, and Sony's had and others have had markets, and most of them have shut it down. So from the gambling perspective, I mean, even the games that don't facilitate a market, there's trading of virtual goods that go on in unauthorized secondary markets. That's what I alluded to earlier, is that I think that is, at least to the cases that have been decided to date, that's a big distinction. You look at the cases against Big Fish and others where they were alleged to be engaged in illegal gambling because people could buy gold and use gold in casinos within the game and win other virtual goods, and those goods could be sold. But all of those items were kind of created by the publisher and could be, they were designed to be consumed within the publisher's, game. And the publisher did not participate in or facilitate the secondary markets. And so when you have that so-called closed market and you have, or a closed-loop system for the virtual goods, essentially, and then unauthorized secondary markets against terms of service, the courts have, there's been at least four cases this year where the courts have found no gambling, even though some of the facts have been similar, a little bit different, but they've all been found no gambling. Whereas with Valve, if you create a market for the secondary market for the goods, and there is, value, then it gets to the question of, if people are risking something of value for the chance of winning something more, right? You put a skin in a pot, you get a pot of skins, you can sell them all. It looks more like gambling.
So I know you guys all have to be somewhere. So I'm going to leave you guys with one last question that has to do with gambling. Earlier, Bryce, you said that something that we should be concerned about, especially people like you guys who are very well versed in the industry. You guys don't want other people coming in who might not know much about the industry touching that issue. And you're saying that, the industry should try to fix this before anyone else comes in and they don't really know what's going on. So if you were on a committee, what would you do to address the problem? What action would you take, or at least what would you start? I don't know. Cause I know you said that, you guys are the ones that people like you can maybe try to fix the problem.
Well, I actually am on the committee. I'm on the founding board of the Sports Integrity Coalition, and so I have to tackle this exact problem.
Okay.
The answer is we need to create a uniform set of standards as it relates to competitive integrity, from match fixing to affirmative cheating, hacking, scripting, DDoS prevention, hardware manipulation. There's so many issues, right? In addition to all the kind of standard cheating issues. Doping is an interesting one, but we'll put that aside for now. The biggest problem we have is not coming up with the best possible standards. It's getting the relevant parties to take a seat at the table and buy into what's being created. Some of these entities don't like each other. In order to have the kind of meaningful impact that I would want to see happen around competitive integrity, gambling, cheating in general, you need all of the major publishers and all the major tournament organizers to say, here's our feedback. We all vote, we adopt something, and these are the rules, and we're going to enforce them across the board. And if someone is banned from cheating, if someone gets banned for some being caught cheating under the rules and procedures of ESIC in the MLG event, then they can't go play in a Turner event, they can't play in a Faceit event, they can't play in a Northern Arena event, right? That's the type of enforcement mechanisms we need for this to be successful. But in order to get there, we need buy-in from all the key stakeholders, and we're just not there yet.
I think it's two parts, as Bryce said. I mean, you can set the rules and standards, then you need an effective enforcement mechanism. And that sometimes is harder, right? It's hard. The first part's hard, too, but the second part is catching the cheating. You have to make sure the integrity is there.
That makes sense.
And I agree with Bryce. I don't think that regulators in general are going to be able to do a better job of defining what should be precluded than folks in the industry.
I think publisher involvement is also important. I think Valve got into trouble because there were these third parties, these websites that were facilitating a lot of trading, and Valve just didn't really do anything to try to police that. And so there was fraud and a whole bunch of issues that arose around that, and then you had these class action lawsuits that named Valve as a responsible party. Valve wasn't actually doing much of it. wasn't really doing any of it, actually. It was like CSGO Diamonds and other sites like that, but Valve wasn't stopping it either. So I think publishers being a little more vigilant about enforcing how their IP is being used or kind of secondary markets that are arising around their IP, that's important.
Just one more very high-level general question. What role do you think lawmakers should take in regulating the space, and what guideposts would you set for them in thinking about how to write laws for esports?
I think like any emerging area, I think they need to take a very balanced and cautious approach. I mean, there's a couple of different issues you want to take a look at. From the gambling perspective, like what is and what's not gambling is an issue that the laws are just antiquated in the first place, right? So as we mentioned earlier, I think they need to be really careful. And I think, you know, I mentioned earlier, like even with fantasy sports, if you look at the definition of what fantasy sports is, some of those definitions don't even make sense. So these new laws that are being, you know, kind of implemented for daily fantasy sports, like some of it covers any contest, right, which doesn't make sense at all. So I think that they need to, you know, to the extent they don't regulate anything, right, I'm just picking the gambling part just because of the DFS analog, I think they just need to be cautious about it. I mean, you want to have, you know, integrity of the game, you want to have consumer protection, you want to prevent, you know, all the things they want to prevent. But I think that, you know, like in any area, if they overregulate or do bad regulation, you're going to end up, you know, kind of killing an industry potentially, right? In a worst case scenario, and so I think just, you know, like all these areas, it's a good balance that's really required. And I think it requires, you know, I mean, I think the more that industry does to self-regulate, the less likely the regulator to get involved. You look at like DFS, right? The whole reason that all of the legal problems started was because of the exposure of alleged, you know, insider trading, so to speak, right? So whenever you have consumer complaints, consumer fraud, you look at Kampu Gacha, which is a game mechanic in Japan, you know, people started complaining. It's if people stay happy, the regulators are less likely to be involved, unless there's clear illegality and other stuff going on. So I think that, you know, it really just requires this balance, and I think the more the industry does to keep things on the up and up, they're going to have a, you know, better chance of kind of controlling their own destiny. But I do think, like in any industry, you're going to have people pushing the envelope, right? We talked about even like what is a skill-based game, right? And so as you start getting people involved, like, you know, all the games we've been talking about are at the very high end of skill-based games. You start getting people doing this and you take games that really aren't skill-based, I think that's where you're going to see some of these issues arise, right?
Yeah.
So it's the, you know, either the bad actors or the people that push the envelope that will cause a problem for others. I mean, I think, you know, the people that are doing this right now are all, you know, kind of right mind and kind of trying to do it the right way and build the industry and put the safeguards in. It's in everyone's benefit to do that. But you'll have people come in that are not aligned with that view, and I think those are the ones that will cause the problem.
Well, thank you all. That was, I really appreciate that. I know you guys have to be, I know someone has to catch a flight. So thank you.
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you,
thank you for
thank
being
you.
Here. All right, perfect.